Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. The price of vol in single stocks, in equity sectors, and across asset classes is on the mind of Stuart Keiser. Now the head of equity derivatives research at UBS, Stuart spends his time helping the firm's institutional clients find value on both the long and short side of the options market. Landing at Goldman Sachs, a stone's throw away from the global financial crisis, Stuart developed his skill set by looking for opportunities in the single stock options market at a time of massive transition and implied volatility. During our conversation, we revisit the surge in option premia in U.S. financials from extremely low to unrecognizably high levels in just a matter of a year. In this context, Stuart shares his views on the vol risk premia, noting that it can sometimes be compelling to sell vol at low levels, especially when markets are trending in muted fashion, as they did in 2017. As part of his process for supporting clients, Stuart continuously evaluates volatility surfaces. He shares the process he uses, describing how he utilizes backtests and how he arrives at points on the curve that carry best and are optimal in the context of the risks being hedged. We also discussed 2018, a year bookended by market disruption events of very different character that required unique construction in hedging. Lastly, Stuart shares his framework for evaluating cross-asset risk factors and how he looks for warning signs that sister asset classes like FX and rates may send to equity investors. Today, amidst a challenging environment for carrying options, he sees value in gold volatility. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Stuart Keiser. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Stuart Keiser. He's the head of equity derivatives research at UBS. Stuart, thanks for coming by and joining me on the Alpha Exchange today.
Great, Dean. Thanks for having me.
Lots for us to talk about in the world of cross-asset vol, a subject matter in which you're an expert and spending a lot of time studying different relationships and making sense of it all. Why don't you give us a little bit of the trajectory of your career history? Start from the start. How did you develop an interest in finance? What did the early days of your career look like?
Yeah, I've taken a very circuitous route to where I've ended up. My first job on the street was actually trading emerging markets fixed income bonds. And if you remember O'Connor Partners, we actually had three of the former O'Connor Partners on that trading desk at what was formerly Swiss Bank. And really an informative place to start because you're trading both cash and options embedded bonds. So Brady bonds have an embedded call option in a lot of them. So you're trading the optionality of the bond, you're trading the bond, you're trading the rate risk, you're trading the FX, and potentially trading the volatility on the FX. So just a lot going on in that job to sort of open your eyes to how complex the markets are and what kind of opportunities there are to sort of have a macro view, have a view potentially on a country or a given credit, but also needing to understand the volatility and the pricing aspects of those assets. So that was step one. Unfortunately, Russia defaulted and our trading desk went from 15 to 5 and I found myself back in grad school. And from there, I did a variety of things, some financial risk management consulting, some risk and portfolio management. But then the big step for me was moving over to Goldman and spending 7 years or so looking at equity markets from both a cash perspective and from both a volatility perspective. So got the opportunity to really work with Buzz Gregory and team to really understand the volatility markets. I did a lot of single stock vol research there. So combining fundamentals with what the options market's giving you, essentially. And basically 200 to 250 trade ideas a year later, really hopefully having a good sense of how to build a fundamentally based catalyst-driven view on a stock or a market or a sector.
In your tenure at Goldman, what was that time period?
I started in October 2007, so okay. Top ticked the market quite nicely.
Yep.
And then basically spent 2 years trying to dig ourselves out of a hole for the most part. But it's funny, when I think back, within a month of me starting in emerging markets was when the Asian flu started. And there was this older Swiss trader who had been at Swiss Bank forever. And he said, you know what? This is great. You're experiencing this your first month. You're never going to see this kind of stuff again. And unfortunately, he was quite wrong because we got to see this repeatedly over the course of the last 20 years. And I mean, I think you know the same would be for people who started in the vol markets in 07 and 08. Never see this again. VIX at 80, et cetera, et cetera. And then lo and behold, we get February of 2018 and we're back at it again.
The 100-year storm every 5 years. A investment vehicle that I speak to, it just asked me to sort of lay out over the last 20 years, just different vol events. And since 1997, so start with Asian Contagion, I count about 20 unique events. Now, none of them are Great Financial Crisis, VIX of 80, but what I find fascinating is just the different epicenter. Some are FX-oriented, some are a product run amok, could be a taper tantrum where the Fed is communicated in a way that makes the market super uncomfortable. I wanted to go back just to talk a little bit more about your single stock research at Goldman, because one of the things that's happening right now in markets is the amount of option volume that's happening in the singles, specifically big cap tech, Microsoft, Tesla, Amazon. There's just an absolute flurry of options activity. And mostly it's upside calls. So you're starting to see it impact the vol surface to the upside. I'm just curious if you sort of think about the time period that we were looking very specifically at single stock volatility surfaces. Any insights that you were particularly surprised to have generated during that time? And what were some of the lessons that you learned in looking at those volatilities?
I think the big lessons, a couple of them. One would be you really do need to understand the fundamentals when you're trading single stock vol. Otherwise, you get caught wrong-footed a lot. And I think the second would be, even though you think these catalysts and events are really well telegraphed, there's still a lot of time is alpha embedded in them, whether that's an analyst day or an earnings day. A lot of times those moves are underpriced a couple weeks ahead of time. And you would think everybody knows exactly when Apple reports or when Google reports or whatever the case may be. But there's still, if you have a strong fundamental view and you're paying attention and being opportunistic on the vol side, I think there's probably more opportunity there than you would have expected in those kind of names. And I just think that really drives it home. I mean, we do a lot of work on vol, fair value, cross asset, et cetera. But in the end, that all has to be done in the context of where are we in the economic cycle? What are the signposts? What's priced? And how can I kind of take advantage of that? And I think a good example today is something like European index vol, which people would have probably told you is cheap for the last couple of years. And then you buy it and you bleed to death because there haven't been enough sort of identifiable and tradable catalysts. So the single stock side is like that, just almost on steroids because there's so many stocks and so many events. So yeah, I think that was the big thing. You know, just drive home, understand the fundamentals before you put it on. And a lot of times these catalysts are probably underpriced in the market if you do have a strong directional view one way or the other.
Doesn't seem like you're looking a lot at single names right now, but I'm curious when you think about the earnings cycle. So four times a year, it's one of the ways I teach the kind of holes in Black-Scholes is, of course, vol is not constant through time because you have four times a year, these very special days that obviously generate volatility. There's a lot of coverage of implied earnings moves. What was your take, if you can recall back, in terms of the market's pricing of those? Is it pretty efficient? Vol is typically higher than realized, so you kind of overpay. Any conclusions that you can recall?
Yeah, I mean, look, coming into this quarter, it was, I think, the lowest average implied move that we'd had in 4 or 5 years. So the market was certainly not expecting a hugely volatile earnings season at the single stock level. Whether they're overpriced or underpriced, obviously, you know, I think the direction matters on that. But in a lot of these, I think they are sort of structurally overpriced in a lot of cases. Like a Google is probably a good example. The implied moves on that stock are often in the double digits because the market has a muscle memory and they don't want to get caught short those options. And I think for a lot of the big name single stocks, the demand is clearly to own options around earnings. Most even fundamentally based investors do not want to be short optionality around earnings. So, I mean, I'd have to go back and look at the history, but it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of times those moves can be almost a little overpriced in the popular high vol names, but then a lot of times they could be underpriced in a lower vol name where people aren't as read in on the fundamentals. So sometimes you need to go a little bit off the beaten path to find really good volatility buying ideas around single stock earnings.
As you got started in single stock vol analysis in 2007, of course, we were in the midst of the biggest spread widening we'd ever seen between something like the XLF and the names in it and the S&P. I'm recalling 2006, XLF probably traded 2 vols over S&P. Spread might have gone to 80 for all I know. It was pretty significant. What was it like looking at single name volatility, specifically in financials, that were oftentimes in the hundreds and 150s, the banks? What analysis were you guys doing? Are these, you got to overwrite these names? How do you think about spending premium or getting premium when the premium is so high during that period?
I agree. It was almost unbelievable. You look at the break evens on this stuff and you'd say, this has to be a sale. And then one of them would report, or a news story would come out, and you'd blow through a break even, and you'd say, well, I sort of guess not, right? So I think that time period, I think a lot of this stuff, you'd say, hey, I can sell a 10% out of the money put and collect X percent premium. And it just looks like a layup historically. But frankly, there was just so little engagement from clients in terms of being willing to be short any kind of volatility on those names. So I think it's one of those things. It was expensive, and it was expensive for a reason. And it created a lot of theoretically very interesting ideas, but practically, I think it was very hard to get a lot of those ideas done because, I mean, as you can remember, you couldn't believe what was going on in these names. I mean, I think overwriting was probably a strategy that appealed to a lot of people, but I actually told our junior guys that work for us a couple months back, I said, go back and just look at September 2008 and look at your daily and weekly moves in the S&P. And, you know, you're printing 8% daily moves at the index level. So even if overwriting was the right trade, it was nearly impossible to hold both emotionally and from a risk management perspective. So I think it's just one of those cases where looking around in hindsight, there was just absolutely home run trades out there. But practically speaking in real time, unfortunately, they were just really, really hard to kind of implement at the time.
It sounds like some of what you've done is, again, on the singles level, what is it that determines implied volatility? Well, it's typically realized has a heavy hand in that result. But there's something about the companies themselves. And financials may be the best example. And I'd love to get your take on this. 2005, 2006, they're getting riskier and riskier, even as their implied volatilities are going down and down and down. CDS and Morgan Stanley traded 20 basis points in early 07. You look inside the companies and you see changes in capital structure, changes in their balance sheets. How does that figure into maybe a predictive model or some model that explains the level of implied volatility, the company fundamentals themselves?
I think intuitively you'd expect the variability of either revenues or earnings to be closer related to the implied volatility of a stock or a sector. So, I mean, if you're levering up your balance sheet, then theoretically that should flow through to more volatility in your reported fundamentals, which theoretically should kind of flow through to volatility of the share price. But I think, as you said, which is 100% correct, if you asked a trader where is implied vol on a stock or a sector, knowing nothing else, they would ask you what it's realizing. I could tell you that the potential realized volatility or earnings volatility of the stock has exploded because it's added a ton of balance sheet leverage, let's say. But if the share price isn't moving, then that potential implied is just never going to get priced because it's too expensive to carry. And if I think back to earlier this year when the VIX was on an 11-12 handle, it still was rich. It was low optically, and it was probably too low relative to the events that were to come. But if somebody can't carry the thing, it almost doesn't matter. And I think that's a lot of what happened with those single stocks is you could have talked to a fundamental analyst and they could tell you, look, my earnings estimates are as wide as they have been in a while. And I have as little certainty about the outcome as I had in a while. But the implied volatility may be low because the thing goes up every day and it's realizing a low vol. And that's ultimately the number one determinant of where implied is going to be.
Post the big financial crisis, as we were saying earlier, there's a bunch of other risk events that are consequential. They're not as gigantic as that one. Are there ones for you that stand out? You were on the buy side as well. Maybe tell us a little bit about that period as well and sort of the managing portfolio risk through some of those events.
Yeah, it's real interesting. If you think of early 2007, I think I went to a Bear Stearns conference where they had some Columbia professors talking about how risky the real estate market was getting. And you know, you attend a number of these and you start to build a narrative in your head. And I was on the buy side at that point at a long short equity fund, but sitting more in a risk management position. And we had pitched the founders to get long the VIX. At that point, you didn't have the ETFs and you really couldn't trade the futures as much. This is back in 2007. So it was VIX calls or VIX call spreads. And I'd actually done a lot of work with Buzz trying to, because I didn't understand that product either at the time. I think nobody did. And we had a lot of trouble really explaining it to a traditional kind of long short portfolio manager, what this product is and what it should behave. And February 07, you had a little blip, and then you had a little blip over the summer that year. And those were kind of shots across the bow in hindsight. But when they were happening, they just seemed like, oh, another buying opportunity, another buy the dip. So I can remember those two. And we think back to the late 90s, you had the Asian flu, and then things calmed down a bit. And then all of a sudden, Russia appeared. So in a lot of these cases, then you had LTCM, of course. In a lot of these cases, you do, in hindsight, have gotten some good clues about it. But A, or do you have the foresight to trade them? And B, do you have the ability to carry these trades that might not work? I mean, if you had bought VIX call spreads in March of 2007, you would have just eaten a lot of premium on those things for months and months and months. And then it might ultimately have realized. So in hindsight, yeah, layup trade. But in real time, it was actually hard to put that amount of capital to risk when the market just wasn't really rewarding you for it.
And that's really the big question, as you said, is you could paint a very uncomfortable risk scenario for an investor. But if the carry on the option is that difficult and the timing is uncertain, it becomes very challenging to hold on. A lot of folks got the financial crisis right, but they just weren't positioned properly because of carry considerations. One of the things, as you mentioned, the sort of VIX call spreads that you guys were doing in 07, one of the things that was interesting about the VIX term structure at that time was it was pretty flat. And right now, and for years, we live in this world of contango and roll down. I'm just curious, as you sort of think about these vol term structures, how does that impact trade construction for you? Maybe just walk us through a little bit of your framework as you step back and look at all these, the grid of numbers across strike and time. How does it figure into the calculus you use to come up with trades for clients?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think the VIX term structure the last couple of years has generally provided some really good opportunities from our perspective, which is our view is you had a lot of medium-term growth risk and you had a lot of election risk. And for that, you could have bought the belly of the curve with almost no roll down and been able to hold some kind of 3 to 6 month implied volatility without getting hurt too bad. And then the front of the curve was super steep. So you could kind of play that roll down as well. So we're definitely clients trying to understand how to properly size those trades and get those trades done. But as much as the steep term structure, I think, frustrates people because they see the VIX at 12 and they say, I need to own some volatility. And then they look out a month and they're saying, why is this thing at 15? Well, you're not buying 1 month, you're buying 1 month forward. So I think that group of people gets frustrated. But from our perspective, it was take advantage of what the vol surface is giving you. And I think that's always the case. Look at what the surface is giving you, understand the catalyst, understand your view, and look for where there are soft spots or look for where those things don't kind of completely agree with one another. And for us, that was be long that 4 to 6 month VIX future. Coming into the year with the election, people were saying how to trade the election. And our view is if you're going to trade fixed strike options 3 months out to trade election events, you're probably going to be really disappointed. But if that fourth month future gets down to a 16, just buy it. The thing's going to carry great and you're going to kind of be long volatility in the range you want to be. And you can sort of roll around with that. So we definitely look at the traditional vol surface, level term, skew, spreads, et cetera. And then within the VIX, we look at obviously the implied realized spread as well as what the slope is giving you. And either A, try to find the best value to express long vol views, which can sometimes be, you know, hand waving, to be honest with you. But the other could just be where is the best place to sell this. So it depends who you're talking to and how they want to express views. But it's very, very rare in my experience that all of the vol surfaces are perfectly priced and aren't giving you something relative to your view that kind of makes sense. So I just think you need to be really thorough about it and honest about what is your view, what are the catalysts for it, and what do you think the potential moves are. I think a lot of times that last bit, what is the market pricing and how might the market react to this event, end up being the most important part. Because you and I can both see the S&P vol surface. There's no secret there. But understanding, hey, when could this happen? If it does happen, how much could it move? And how much do I think is actually already priced into the markets? That is maybe more art than science. And that's where a lot of these discretionary PMs are really making their money. You know, we talked to a number of folks who traded Brexit, for instance, and they would say, hey, my Brexit view is right. It priced 2 weeks later than I expected and my trades were already expired. Right. Or when it priced, I thought pound was going to move and instead FTSE moved or something like that. So it ended up being they had the view right, but sort of timing it right and understanding which assets would provide you that response factor was a little bit harder. So it's been a tough year to do this stuff.
Yeah. And you mentioned Brexit. So that certainly was a sharp risk event. And it was interesting to see how fully priced it was in British pound options as kind of the epicenter. And then it felt like there was the spillover capital, hedging capital that got exhausted in the main asset, the pound. And then you started to see Euro stocks vol go up and then S&P vol followed. And then post 2016, we had this ice age for vol, this tail event of low vol. I'd just love to get your thoughts on how it is that the S&P underrealizes 2006, which was sort of the height of the credit bubble, by 35% in 2017. And of course, this led into the XIV event. What was on your mind in 2017 is kind of we watched the realization of incredibly muted daily returns, and then we see this XIV product getting bigger and bigger. Just love to hear your thoughts on that.
Rebecca Chung in our trading desk has done a lot of work on this. And her view on 2017, which I agree with, is it was a period of time when you got real retail engagement into the market. And retail tends to be a very slow bleed, grind higher type market. And in that market, it just crushed realized volatility, right? It was the lowest realized volatility since the mid to late 60s, I think. So it was stunningly low. It's funny that that happened after a surprise election as well. You know, everybody's saying how volatile elections are going to be. Well, we arguably had the biggest surprise we've ever had. And the next year was the least volatile year we've had in 50 years. So I think what you had coming out of that was you had a big election event followed by what ended up being pretty supportive policy from a tax cut perspective and things of that nature. And you were able to re-engage retail, who ended up just being a very passive buyer, buying every dip you could imagine. And it just slowly kind of ground volatility lower. And as you know, when that happens, people then, it becomes almost self-fulfilling. If it's going to be this low, I can sell vol into it, and I'm going to continue to do that. I mean, one of the biggest misnomers out there is you can't sell vol when vol is low. Actually, it's often the best time to sell vol is when vol is low. So you almost ended up in this self-fulfilling prophecy of retail buying the market, pushing vol down, then allowing vol selling on top of that. And it just squeezed everything in. And you saw what happened to XIV, went from 40 to 60 or something, and then to zero. I think to me, it's that was had a lot to do with A, probably slightly better policy than the market had been expecting. And then B, just retail engagement that completely just squeezed vol in and then allowed people to actually squeeze it in even further through vol selling and risk premium harvesting strategies and things of that nature.
You make a really interesting point there, and I'd love to see what your thoughts are on this. So the concept of selling vol when it's low, as you said, it actually can accrete value so quickly. The decay can be fantastic in your favor. You're selling it at a thin level, but the realized in 2017 was at a 40% discount to the average VIX. I think the average VIX was 11 and the realized was 6.5. We haven't seen a discount on a percentage basis that big in, I don't think, ever. The other part would be, well, you want to sell vol when it's sky high because it's coming down. Now, what makes vol sky high is massive realized. Have you done work on just the regimes around which it's better to be a vol seller? Any kind of insights on when it works or when you're supposed to be careful? Because obviously that did kind of end in tears, but you definitely clipped a lot of coupons along the way. So maybe you were better off.
I haven't done a ton of work on it, but I would say what we hear from clients a lot is even an overwriting strategy, a lot of times they'll have a trigger in there that you stop overwriting when your premium generated is below a certain amount or when your implied vol is below a certain amount. And I think that's probably true on the upside. I mean, the hardest time, it's funny, the hardest time to sell vol is when it's the highest, ultimately, because the market's effectively realizing that stuff. So, I mean, how do you time that? I think it's almost impossible to know because you don't know how long that high volatility period is going to persist. So you probably need to be doing some type of work to understand when you think that event has begun to peter itself out and then get it done. So maybe you probably need to, how we were looking at it is if you think of like an inverted curve, once the curve inverts, we conceptually consider it inverted until you get a full point of slope back in the front end. So that just gives you a sense. It's not a good answer, but once it inverts, people are saying, well, it's not inverted anymore. And I say, no, it's inverted until you get a full point to slope back in. Otherwise, you're just sort of in this either inverted or flat term structure environment, which is to some extent no man's land. So I haven't done the work on it, but my first start would be at what point in the slope or in realized are you comfortable that the risk reward is now in your favor to be selling vol. And I would say you're probably better to be a little late than a little early on that trade, which is why we sort of say, hey, wait, let's get a point. Get us a point between the VIX and UX1, and then we'll talk about, you know, the curve being kind of normal again. So I don't have a back-tested answer for you, but that's sort of conceptually how we think about it when we're looking at it.
And the other thing that you alluded to, I think, was just positioning. It's when a market is caught off guard and positioning is off sides that you can get a significant snap. I find positioning to be very elusive. We see a little bit of data. We don't see most of it, whether it's OTC or global vol trades. Sometimes these things are highly embedded in different products that you'd never see the light of day on. How should we think about the published data, whether it's CFTC data, open interest data? How useful do you find it? How do you use it? And what sort of signals might come out of some analysis? There's a lot of talk these days about put-call ratios that are moving around. What's your sense on that?
I mean, we look at the data, but to your point, we take it with a big grain of salt. So, I mean, we definitely look at the CFTC data of either non-commercial or lever funds to get a sense for where that positioning is. Obviously, in this day and age, you probably need to combine that exposure with some assumption on what the total ETF exposure is there. So, but to me, those are also, some people say those are the same account. I don't know if those are the same accounts trading that, but I feel like the behavior in the futures market might be a little bit different than the behavior of the people that are owning those ETFs. So I do think you want to look at them collectively, but I think you also need to look at them a little bit separately just to get a sense of what's out there. The other positioning beyond that, I agree, is I think it's very, very opaque, or it just takes a massively long list of assumptions to estimate whatever the net gamma of the market or the total vega, because you don't know how much of this stuff is being traded in relative vol strategies. You don't know how much of it is structured retail flow. Some of the biggest buyers of VIX and VIX options, some of them hedge that stuff, some of them don't. Some of them monetize it, some of them don't. Some put buyers monetize puts, some roll them lower, which have obviously different impacts on what's going on. So I think all you could do is collect as much data as you can, talk to clients, talk to trading desks to try to get their feel on how the market's been trading, and do your best. To me, I don't think there's an end-all and be-all answer to that question other than, yeah, we look at the CFTC stuff, we look at the ETFs, we do look at put-call ratio, we do look at open interest and flows. But it's very hard to really put all that together and come up with, let's say, a number. If you remember back in December of 18, when the market started selling off, we were down 20% in a short period of time. All of a sudden, puts that were 20% out of the money were now back as 50 delta options. So your typical calculation of how much gamma or vega was in the market, or gamma in that case, because they're pretty short dated, would have ignored those puts. You probably would have like just trimmed those off and not even really paid attention to them. So that even adds another layer on of what is that sort of legacy position out there that probably at that point is either A, fully delta hedged, or B, just written off as like a lottery ticket sitting there. So I think all this stuff is very hard. I think a lot of times, whether it's in cash equities or in vol, sometimes the best way to sniff out positioning is to look at how the market's behaving. If the street's long gamma, you're going to probably see that in how futures or cash is trading. If the market's really short a lot of VIX, you're probably going to sort of see that in how the market's trading in the shape of the curve and or in the premium of futures to where the spot's potentially going to settle. So we do this on the cash side as well. We try to understand what are bottom-up quant factors telling us? What are different varieties of factors telling us about the market? To me, I think that's very informative, because if everybody is telling me, well, the market's real defensively positioned and but cyclicals are really outperforming and call open interest and IWM and FXI jumps 200% in 2 weeks. Well, tell me what you want to tell me, but I'm going to also look at that data and I'm going to believe sort of what's going on in the market as much as I'm going to believe some estimate of gamma from whomever might be making that estimate.
Yeah, you have to kind of triangulate in some ways. I remember it was the summer of 2017, so super low vol. Had a little blip on North Korea. Trump is tweeting. And it was probably the high of the VIX for the year. It got to 16. But I remember very specifically the beta of VIX futures, of VXX, and the volume specifically in VXX that day was so off the charts. It was like the S&P was following the vol market rather than vice versa. And it was a sort of, to me, an indication that, wow, this product's gotten pretty big. There's a lot of people chasing this thing back and forth. And it was probably a pretty good precursor to what happened. Tell us just about your role at UBS and sort of how you think about the product that you deliver. I can imagine you're not just thinking about trade construction in the markets, but you're in the data lab building models. I'd love to learn a little bit more about your team orientation. And because you've been in both the buy side and the sell side for a while, just the way in which over the years, maybe this role has evolved in a market that things change over time. Just be curious to learn a little bit more about the role.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think our team is probably a little non-traditional, maybe, in terms of how vol research is generally done, just in the sense that we sit within macro strategy and we're very reliant or linked up with what our econ views are, what our kind of view on the cash equity is, and then vol is another piece. So there's almost three pillars to what we're doing. So I think we're probably not as deep on the structuring side or the math side of volatility, for lack of a better term, but we're much more, I think, involved in relative value, fair value in the context of how we view the world. So we kind of approach it is the first step is understand the investment environment you're in. And a lot of that has to do with the business cycle, among a couple other things. Try to get a sense for in that type of environment, what assets perform well, what assets perform poorly, what assets have the most skew, the most kurtosis, things of that nature. Then the next step is, hey, well, how much of that do we think is priced? And that can be obviously a little bit of art, but you try to understand what do you think is priced. And then the last bit, I think, is from an options perspective, what is the market telling you about how that risk is priced? And is there an opportunity there? So that's sort of a progression that we would kind of go through if we were trying to come up with, hey, what's our favorite idea? Well, in the current context, we'd say our U.S. economists expect this a sharp slowdown in economic activity. Historically, that's impacted these assets the most. These are the assets that we think are not fully reflecting that. And then from a vol perspective, then which of those assets offer you the best payouts or the best risk reward? So sometimes vol can come at the end. Other times it'll be the opposite. Other times we'll look at relative volatilities and then work backwards that way. So sorry to give you two completely different answers. But a good example would be earlier this year is oil vols and energy vols were just exceptionally high in all of our models. And so that was the starting point is, well, how do we either deal with this or how do we take advantage of this? And when you start at that level, okay, now we start with really high oil vol and the view that growth might slow and an observation that we've had very big event risk in oil, but have actually gotten very little sustained price response. So we were then big sellers of upside in oil equities and in USO or oil itself. So sometimes start with our fair value model. Sometimes we'll start with the macro view because I think this is almost like a circle and it just depends where you want to enter it. So we're probably less helpful at doing real deep relative value analysis within the vol surface and maybe a little more helpful at understanding investment environment, upcoming catalysts, and signposts and trying to understand how those things are fully or less than fully priced.
One of the things that I try to think about is what are the prime causes of volatility? Where is it that a market just suddenly becomes more volatile or what are the conditions that give rise to stability? And at least some of it can be linked back to the stability of the business cycle, at least for now. You look at the realized vol of CPI, the realized vol of GDP, it's low. Is that a framework in which you guys think is to tie the VIX, for lack of a better metric, to back to the U.S. business cycle?
We definitely do. We kind of look at the business cycle, how I would describe it, in three speeds. So we've got a very nice like sine curve looking thing, which would be called that the output gap. And then our core view would be 3-month momentum in ISM and core CPI. We also supplement that looking at both claims and the unemployment rate, which I think is another. A lot of times the unemployment rate tends to be the thing that's most closely related to vol, which I think surprises people, surprised us when we first looked at it. And then the last one is we have what I would call just a very high speed tactical update on the business cycle. And UBS has a team called Evidence Lab, which is sort of our data science group. And they're using quote unquote big data to get what's essentially a real-time update on U.S. economic growth. So they're not trying to estimate the level of growth. They're just looking at month-on-month, has growth accelerated or decelerated meaningfully? So I could tell you, hey, we think we're in expansion, but then if my medium speed would say, hey, but we may be having this sort of short-term slowdown in ISM related to the tightening of rates last year or something like that. And my high-speed data is actually telling me that that is going to manifest itself this month, for instance. So we do spend a lot of time trying to understand business cycle dynamics. What I would say is, generally speaking, for the last couple of years, vol has underrealized what the business cycle would have told you. The deceleration we had in ISM, especially with what was going on in inflation, historically should have put realized vol in the high teens and the VIX probably in the low 20s. And we've only gotten there very, very episodically. So we look at the business cycle for us is sort of pillar one, and pillar two is what we would call market internals. And that's just saying, where should the VIX be relative to S&P realized vol and short-term S&P price moves? So we're going to look at 10, 20, and 60-day realized. We're going to look at one-week moves in the S&P and say, essentially, the VIX is realized vol plus an implied vol premium plus a skew premium. And unless you have a short-dated move in the markets that will dislodge you from baseline realized, then that very simple construct does a pretty decent job of saying, where would you put the stake in the ground on the VIX? And we run that same structure cross asset, and it tends to work fairly well. And then our third approach would be cross asset risk pricing. So there we're trying to understand, we use the CBOE VIX indices, of which there's 20, and we grab the principal component out of that, and we say that that is global or core volatility. And we say, relative to where global volatility is, where should each of these individual risk assets be priced? And that's based on their relationship to global vol over the last 2 years. So basically, you're saying, all right, the business cycle would put me here. The asset's performance itself would put me here. And its standing in the global risk structure would put it there. We then try to understand where we think value is according to all of those. And a lot of times the most interesting is when you get conflicting signals. Brazilian equity implied volatility has been a good example of that this year. Historically, Brazil is a risk asset. So when you have global risk move, you would expect EWZ implieds to jump. That hasn't really happened. And one of the reasons it hasn't happened is because it hasn't been realizing. So the asset itself has been rallying and had low realized vol. So you get this situation where if global risk sentiment continues to deteriorate, you would actually expect at some point EWZ vols to jump. But outside of that, the internal market dynamics have kept it very well anchored. So that's kind of how we try to weigh these things. And at some point, it is your qualitative call. But we do at least try to be loyal to what our frameworks are telling us. So that was a long answer to a short question.
Well, I was going to follow up because I think Brazil is one example. I can imagine as you look at the landscape of vols across the different asset classes, FX sticks out like a sore thumb in terms of just being very low, not realizing in the realized vol side. What does that tell you? Frame that for us. Equity vol versus FX vol and rate vol. What is it telling us about the world?
Last year, at this time, you would have had a similar situation where FX vol looked very low and rates vol actually looked pretty low. Rates vol isn't quite as low this year as it was last, but you certainly had a situation where those two assets, both implied and realized vol, were exceptionally low. And investors were looking at that and saying, why is this? And I think a lot of it has been policy, economic policy, central bank policy is sort of suppress the volatility in those asset classes in particular. And lo and behold, when did we see those vols move? It was really over the summer last year when the Fed started to be in question. Will they hike? Will they cut? And then the ECB kind of also got dragged into this. What is their policy stance going to be as Draghi starts to cycle out? So to me, the vol in rates and FX has very much been driven by central bank policy. So I think to think those vols will move meaningfully, you either think you're going to need A, a policy mistake, or B, just a shift in the policy dynamic, or C, something that is so existential that it just bids this stuff up. I mean, I mentioned European equity vol before being a bit of a graveyard of it looks cheap, but then you buy it and you bleed to death. I mean, yen vol has definitely been that because yen is traditionally a very highly cyclical risk on, risk off asset. The vol has been cheap. People don't want to spend premium. So I think people have tried to play that. The other thing we've seen is folks looking longer dated, let's say out 24, 36 months and saying, you know, I'm going to own variance on FX and rates and I'm going to sell capped equity variance against that. On the view that for this to really fall apart, it almost takes a policy mistake. And if I get a policy mistake, there's the most convexity in those assets. So look, this is selective. People do different things, but that's how we've thought about it. The other thing I would mention in our cross-asset models, if you look at the weightings of each individual asset in that sort of global vol factor, yen and 10-year are a much larger weight over the last 2 years than they have been over the previous 5 to 10. So while those vols are low, they're also a bigger contributor to week-on-week changes. So I think what that's telling you is what could set off a cross-asset risk event. I think it would have to come from those assets to some extent. But if it did come from those assets, pay close attention to it. And we've sort of highlighted, I would say, probably 3 to 4 times over the last 18 months, periods of time when TYVIX or JYVIX move, and we don't see a related move in equity vol over the same time window. We always highlight those to just say, hey, cross-asset risk factors are sending a signal here. It could be idiosyncratic, but these are bigger contributors to global risk than they have been in the past. They both moved. This is something to keep an eye on. So that's, we do think they're held low by policy. By the same token, when they do move, you best pay attention because they haven't been moving much recently.
The yen vol is a good question around just the comings and goings of how assets behave. These betas are not set in stone. And it's an interesting and challenging question to ask yourself, how much of the past data do you incorporate? I mean, even just risk managing a book of equities, at some point, 2008 kind of falls out of the equation. But it certainly didn't fall out of the equation in 2009 or 2010. You still have that both in your memory, but also the data seems relevant to you. But 10 years later, as you shock your portfolio, 2008 is probably not front and center in terms of what's reasonable over the course of a 3 to 6 month period. And I'm just curious, when you think about how you use data, there's a lot of criticism of Wall Street in terms of strategies that overfit results. Something's going to win the beauty contest, right? How do you balance the in sample versus out of sample considerations? How does someone like you approach that question?
Yeah, I think there's a number of questions embedded in there. One is how to deal with outliers. I do not like throwing data out personally.
It happened.
Yeah, it happened. So it's real. So let's not ignore it. The problem is then sometimes your regressions will overfit to the outliers. So I believe at some stage in your research, you need to leave all of that data in and understand how it behaved. If later you want to do some statistical techniques, robust regressions or something to dampen that, that's fine. But I don't like to do that at the outset. I like all of my data in there. And to least, because your point, it happened. So if it happened, we shouldn't ignore it, because if it happened, people are going to use it as a scenario as well, right? I mean, this is what PMs do. If something is happening right now with coronavirus, you're looking at SARS. The market and China's impact on the market is completely different today than it was in 2003. But that is the thing people look back at as an example. So I think when you then throw that information out of your data set, you're sort of ignoring something, A, that happened, and B, that you know practitioners are going to anchor to if it happens again. So I think it's very important to include all of that data, even if ultimately you do try to dampen its impact a bit. That said, most of our models are built using generally like a 2-year look back in our betas and in our sensitivities, because a lot of fair value models, underlying them is an assumption that the correlation structure of the market is going to be stable. Because you're saying, hey, yen vol is cheap right now. Well, why? Because it typically responds more than it has. So you're assuming then that it should respond as it has in the past, which to me is you're assuming some sort of stable relationship or correlation structure. And that's always very tricky, because that works until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, then you have a regime shift and you're in a lot of trouble. So what we typically do is for our week-to-week models, we're using kind of a 2-year look-back window with all the data involved. We will run everything on longer windows just for comparison's sake. We may look at that at the background. We will look at full sample as well. I think full sample work is a little bit scary to me, because you'd have no out of sample then. And dealing with out of sample is a little tricky too, is what is your out of sample? A lot of folks will just, okay, I'll save my last 2 to 3 years of data. But that 2 to 3 years of data, there's some selection bias there. And that 2 to 3 years might not be similar. So a lot of times we'll play around with what portion or chronology of the data we leave out. We'll do a lot of simulation work to some extent to try to deal with that as well. I mean, all you can do, I think, is be honest about your approach. And we publish our models. Everything is out there. This is the data we use. These are the statistics. These are the betas. This is the data. I mean, this isn't rocket science. So we're happy to share all of that. But I do think you need to have some sort of honesty about how you do it. And for me, that means include all the data to start with. If you're going to take any of it out, be very, very honest about that. But if you're using a model that is meant to be market responsive, then I do think you need to use a shorter model that's more consistent with how the markets are behaving today. And again, all of these things have inherent risk with them. And we just have to accept that, I guess.
Right. I'm curious, when you look at all of these different vol surfaces, it's nice to have ETFs that represent non-equities now, HYG, LQD, got FX ETFs, of course, the vol products themselves. Are there levels, whether it's across strike or skew or term structure? It sounds like EWZ is one of them. Are there other prices that you look at and say, man, that's compellingly high or compellingly low, either on an absolute basis, a carry basis, or on a relative pricing basis? What really sticks out to you right now?
In the markets today, FX, obviously, which we touched on, SX5E implieds to us look pretty attractive. And for the first time in a while, gold actually screens a bit low in our framework. That's a new one. It hasn't been the case for a bit. On the high side, frankly, it's anything energy related. So whether that's USO vols, XLE vols, things of that nature. And frankly, the VIX still screens a little bit rich in our models, and probably could explain that if we really tried to. But that's sort of the how things are stacking up at the moment, which is FX looking a little low, gold a little low, Europe a little low. Sector-wise, rate-sensitive sectors have the most attractive vol to us right now. So that's going to be consumer staples, financials, and utilities. And then on the high side would be kind of a little bit of tech, retailing, and energy, of course. That's the general landscape in which we're kind of operating. Within DM, it's going to be IWMs and SX5Es would be the two that jump out at us as the most attractive vols on a global basis.
The longer dated VIX futures have been heavily traded. There's the election hump that's already there. It's quite interesting. I'm curious what your take is. It's very far away. Sanders is doing well in the polls. The market keeps going up. What do you make of that pricing between SEP, OCC, and no VIX futures? Because that hump is decided. We saw a similar hump in Brexit and in the precursor to the French election, but it was only about a month away for each of those. And to see it already in the VIX curve, I find it can't explain it really. I'm curious if you have thoughts on it.
It does seem a little bit early. And I wonder if that hump is supply or demand driven. Is this just dealers not wanting to be short those
futures?
Do not
sell this option.
Exactly. Right. So it could be risk managers tapping people on shoulders. So it could be supply or demand driven. I'm a little surprised to see the hump this early. I was surprised in October when people were worried about an Elizabeth Warren nomination and were trying to hedge Super Tuesday 6 months out too. So it's the story of the day and people are going to trade it. For me personally, I'd much rather trade it through a VIX future than through a fixed strike put or put spread. I just think that's a better way to do it. I think you need to be very opportunistic about the level. I think buying those futures on an 18 handle, I'm not sure where they are today, to be completely honest with you. I think that's a little rich. If I could get them on a 16 handle, then I like that trade a bit more. In terms of Sanders, the market and the street seems pretty convinced that he's not nationally electable. I don't know if that's true or not. I have no way for me to know. But what that says to me is that even if there's only a 1 in 4 chance that he could win the national, those odds are grossly underpriced by the market. I mean, the market's probably pricing 5 or 10, and maybe the real probability is 25. I'm just throwing out numbers. I don't really have a good estimate for you. So I do think at some point, as the Democrats coalesce around a candidate, the actual odds of each candidate winning are going to need to be repriced to some extent. It seems like right now folks are saying, well, Sanders is trending well. That's actually good for Trump. Not necessarily my narrative. This feels like the market narrative. And because of that, I can be bullish the market and I don't need to worry about a Democrat win. So at some point, I do think even though the odds might not go to 50-50, they're probably still too low relative to what the actual is. And there's a lot of odds here, right? There's, from a Sanders perspective, for instance, the odds that he wins the nomination, the odds that he wins the election, the odds that the Democrats win the Senate. So there's, you're stacking odds on top of odds on top of odds, which makes it even more complicated. But it's one of those things. I mean, the real, and macro traders love this stuff. The real odds might be 10%, but they're only priced at 3%. So I want to, on a relative value, own those odds. It doesn't mean I think the event's going to happen. It's just I think the distribution of it happening are a little off. So that's the part that I think we'll need to readjust more than anything as we kind of move through the Democratic primary season.
Let's finish with this. This is the conundrum for all people trading volatility. If I map the VXX, which is just long the VIX future rolling, and I map the XIV, rest in peace, XIV, and I start them in, let's say, 2012, and I go to 2018, February 2018, they both effectively went to zero. The VXX on a slow bleed, we know what that contango does. The pre-split adjusted issue price of the TVIX, the 2x VIX, is $250 million. It trades at $40 now, okay?
Sounds like Zimbabwe currency.
It's a remarkable comment on roll down and vol. But the XIV had a untimely death as well. So what do you think about just long vol versus short vol? Some people will never sell vol. Some people will never buy it. How do you think about the balancing and sort of how clients should be using volatility in their portfolios?
I'll start with the short vol side. To me, obviously, there's a great sharp ratio on this stuff until there's not. And to your point, it's you make a ton of money and then you lose it all in a short period of time. I just think there's a lot of different ways to sell vol. And I think that that's maybe underappreciated. If you think of just the VIX simply, you can sell variance. You can basically trade realized. You can trade the implied realized spread. You can trade skew. And then in the term structure, you can actually trade time. So it could just be at different points in time in your career, there's just a better way to attack it, or there's a better vol premium to try to be harvesting out of the market. For me, as an equity investor, I would think your entry point really matters. So it is painful to be selling volatility at really low levels because you know your risk reward is kind of skewed in one direction. Though, as we talked before, that is sometimes the best time to do it. So I think what we've seen a lot of folks do is just be short vol, but either size it correctly or have some sort of tail hedge kind of overlaying that. On the long vol side, it's the opposite. You're paying the premium into the market. And how do you approach that? I think is what we've seen the last, I think, year or two is actually quite interesting. And if I think of the market narrative, in December of 2018, the market was down 20, the VIX barely moved. And a lot of folks said the VIX is dead. It's dead as a hedging product, because if I can't get a VIX move on a 20% S&P move, what's the point of me holding this stuff anymore? I'm just going to trade S&P skew. That S&P skew got really well bid. You had some large buyers of VIX and VIX call options last summer. who paid off really well over a short period of time. And I think that reminded people a bit, whoa, wait a second, I can use that convexity on the VIX. And in a grind higher market, it's really hard to monetize puts. But if you're opportunistic about the VIX side of it, you can actually make money. So I think it's a lot of it has to do with what kind of market do I think I'm in and what kind of event or risk am I hedging? You kind of need to choose the right way to be long and short volatility relative to those two situations. For instance, in the current market, we had the fear of a global pandemic and the S&P barely pulled back. So people didn't make a whole lot of money on owning skew probably in that environment. But the VIX did jump from 12 to, I think it got up to almost 18. So if you were quick to monetize that, you actually paid off probably a little bit better. I haven't looked at the relative payoffs. I'm just sort of, you know, back of a napkin on this stuff right now. So I think it does matter how you do it and when you do it. And it also depends on what type of investor you are. Are you a pension who's going to be structurally running some sort of, let's say, put spread collar and trying to optimize the cost of that? Or are you a macro or absolute return investor who wants some tail risk that is going to have convexity when the event occurs? I feel like depending on the client type you're discussing this with, the answer to that is just ends up being really, really different. Right. So I'm a fan of generally keeping things relatively short dated and rolling them. From a macro perspective, I do think you really need to have a view on what the market is priced and what the upcoming catalysts are and trying to trade around that stuff really well. I think just like blindly having a tail risk hedge in your portfolio, it just gets real, real expensive. Everybody's upset about the cost of it afterwards. What I always try to tell investors, a hedge is supposed to lose money.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
be happy that your hedge lost money.
Exactly.
Meet a client who says, oh, we're up 30% this year, and my PM is upset that our hedging program cost us 150 bips.
Yeah, you don't want your house to get flooded after you bought flood insurance.
Exactly. I don't know if I really answered the question well, but I do think, look, I think structurally being short vol as part of your portfolio, I think makes sense. I am a proponent of vol as an asset class. I think that's a legitimate way to view things. But, you know, properly sizing it and properly identifying the risk premium that you want to harvest out of the market and targeting that specific risk premium, I think makes the most sense. On the long side, I think it's really understanding, what do you think the risk is? When might it occur? And what type of move would that have on your portfolio specifically? It's easy for me to tell you, hey, yen vol looks really cheap. That's a great tail risk hedge. But if your book isn't set up in a way that a yen hedge is going to help you, well, that sort of doesn't, it's not a good recommendation. I've made you a good relative value recommendation, but practically speaking, it's not going to help you. And even something as simple as a put spread, you have these debates. Well, why are you trading a put spread? Well, I just want to reduce costs. Well, a lot of times if you just choose the strike in between your put spread strikes, buy less puts, but keep your convexity, or don't just use the spread to hit a budget number. We can get you to that budget number. The answer to that question to me is, well, how much of a move do you expect over what time frame? And then we can structure the right hedge for you at the right cost, as opposed to just saying, well, I've got 100 basis points of spread, or I need a 5x payout on a put spread. But that doesn't mean that that's sort of the right structure to put in your portfolio. So I do think sort of really understanding, being honest with yourself of what's my book look like, what are the risks that I'm trying to hedge, and what are the assets that are most likely to accomplish that, is better than finding some esoteric great relative value trade that pays out 12-1 in a scenario that's actually not going to manifest itself in your portfolio specifically.
Well, we covered a lot of ground in 55 minutes. Really appreciate you being a guest today. Thanks for coming by.
Great. Thanks, Dino. Let me just very quickly read the disclosures that compliance requires me to read. And that is, for the latest conflict disclosures on any of the securities discussed in this podcast, please see ubs.com/disclosures. Thanks very much, Dean.
Thanks for listening to the Alpha Exchange. Before we go, I wanted to share with you an inspirational investment symposium I'm hosting on April 23rd on behalf of Macro Minds, the foundation I launched last year. The idea behind Macro Minds is to help raise money for nonprofits that focus on improving educational opportunities for children in the New York area. Our initiative is based on two primary ideas. First, education shortfall for families is self-reinforcing. One statistic: the children of college-educated parents are 7x as likely to go to college as the children of high school dropouts. Working together, we can help break this cycle. The second idea behind Macro Minds is that the community of finance is at its best when we engage in person on the many difficult questions out there. Disinflation, geopolitical instability, crowded trades, and the 2020 election are some of these. Set against these risks, what are the considerations relevant to portfolio construction? What's the next big thing in finance and markets? On April 23rd, these important and complex topics will be explored and provide a stimulating venue for collaborative interaction with focused market professionals. We're also throwing a great party. More on MacroMinds and the symposium can be found at www.macrominds.org. I thank you for your support and hope to see you on April 23rd.